From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, Greece depends on Germany, Australia depends on China, Puerto Rico depends on Washington, D.C. In economics, it's all about interdependence, which has many people wondering what debt crises and stock market troubles abroad mean for them. We'll get an update on the economic news from Greece and China, and we'll discuss the interconnectedness of the world's markets. How fragile is the global economy? Join us for Forum. It's up next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. The financial crises in Greece and China have been dominant in the news recently, and in many minds, they would seem far off from each other beyond the geographic distance. But with the global economy, there is much which connects the economies of different nations. Closer to home, Puerto Rico is also facing a crisis with its $72 billion debt. So how much are economies interconnected and interdependent upon one another, and how fragile is the world's economy, or for that matter, our own here in the United States? Or in California, which is the eighth biggest economy in the world. We're going to take all that up in this morning's opening forum hour. And let me tell you who is joining us for the discussion. I want to welcome Sean Donnan, who covers international economics for the Financial Times. He's with us this morning from Washington, D.C. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you. And he's in Maryland. Also, James Galbraith is with us, and he's in Vermont, in Townsend, Vermont. He's an economist, professor, University of Texas at Austin, and author of The End of Normal. Welcome, James Galbraith.
Thank you.
Glad to have you, and glad also to have Robert Kahn, who is with us this morning from Washington, D.C. He is Stephen A. Tannenbaum, Senior Fellow for International Economics with the Council on Foreign Relations. And we welcome you as well, Robert Kahn.
Thanks for having me on.
Good to have you on. And we are going to begin with Sean Donnan because we want to get an update, obviously, on what's going on. And let me begin by just getting a sense of Greece, if I could, from you, Sean. There's been no debt relief. The government is facing a key vote on that, whether or not to accept the creditor proposed reforms in exchange for a third bailout with no haircut. But by most lights, this is even a worse deal than the one before. So we're getting buyer's remorse from Tsipras, and we're getting all kinds of, new things into the mix here, aren't we?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's certainly a lot of noise, and that's going to be, it's been a feature of Greece throughout, and it's going to be a feature of the Greece crisis for a lot of time. Like you said, the real focus today is on a vote in the Greek parliament, and the big question there is whether Alexis Tsipras, the Greek prime minister, can get the backing of the parliament for this new deal that he negotiated last weekend in Brussels with Angela Merkel and other Eurozone leaders. So far, the signs are that it's going to be a pretty tight thing. And he's got a big rebellion on his hands from Syriza, his party. And you've got to remember that this is a government that was elected basically saying it wanted to rewrite the rules or the deal that it had with creditors. And it's actually, as you say, ended up with a deal that many people consider a lot tougher than one they could have had even a couple of weeks ago.
Well, it did, at least for the present, serve to keep Europe, that is the Eurozone, from fracturing, and there's still plenty to worry about, as you suggest, with Greece and its economy. But the president, that is President Obama, welcomed the agreement and said, I'm quoting here, in a speech he gave to Germany, France, and British leaders Tuesday on the Iran nuclear deal, the agreement is a positive step that could help to underpin a return to growth and debt stability in Greece, but further work will be required. Is that optimistic?
It is optimistic, but it pays to be optimistic right now, and I think everyone's trying to be optimistic right now. That issue of debt sustainability on Greece and that issue of the work that still has to come is, I mean, we need to remember that even if this passes the Greek parliament today, if it goes to the German parliament on Friday, where there's a lot of skepticism as well, and it passes that, you still have probably weeks of negotiations ahead, potentially months, and there is this big issue that's still hanging out there, and that came up, it has come up in the last 24 hours when the IMF released this astonishing document that it had presented to the Eurozone leaders last weekend, and that basically said that Greece's debts are highly unsustainable and that Europe is going to have to wake up to the fact that it needs to do some serious restructuring of those debts. It needs to offer Greece some kind of serious debt relief. Jack Lew, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, is on his way to Germany later today and will be meeting with the German finance minister tomorrow in Berlin, and he's going to be making exactly that point. There's a lot of work left to happen.
And we should mention that those debts are actually going up. They're on the rise from the time of the referendum. But let me shift gears, if I may, with you, Sean Donnan, and talk about China, the world's second largest economy, and they're in a trade slump. They've got a troubled stock market. A lot of wags are telling us, like Jamie Dimon from J.P. Morgan, nothing really to worry about here. Even on the other hand, Larry Summers says it's a bigger threat to the world economy than Greece is. How do you see it?
Well, I think Larry Summers is right. This is a bigger threat to the global economy than Greece, and that's simply a matter of size. This is, we're talking about the world's second largest economy in China versus versus Greece, which is 0.5% of global GDP. It's actually a tiny economy in global terms. We've had some new numbers out today from China showing that the economy there is growing at a rate of roughly 7%. That looks incredibly fast to us here in the U.S., and we're growing at 1 or 2%. The reality is that China's economy is on a slowing trajectory. Month by month, year by year, China's economy is going to be slowing over the years to come, and there's huge adjustments in the economy that we're going to see as a result. Now, that leads to all sorts of turmoil along the way. One of the latest things that we've seen is this remarkable crash in the stock exchange. It's down 30% on where it was just a few months ago. But what we also need to keep in context is that versus where it was a year ago, it's up 87% or so. It's one of those big pieces in the global economy that is moving and that is kind of reverberating out and that we're going to be feeling and having to watch for months to come.
I also can't help thinking almost reflexively of how much the United States owes China and how indebted we are, at least in terms of capital. So it gets me right to the point, and I want to hear from you on this, Sean Donnan, and then we'll talk with Robert Kahn and James Galbraith. But how much is all of this, and we'll bring Puerto Rico into the picture too, which may be on the verge of bankruptcy with $72 billion in debt, how much is this global economy really totally interlocked and interconnected?
Well, I mean, we are living in one of the great areas of globalization, and we are more interlocked than we've ever been in some ways. The Chinese stock market crash was having an impact on iron ore prices that were being traded, across the ocean. So I think we can't escape these big movements and these big events in the global economy. The question is, how do they feed through, and what does it mean in practical terms for someone in San Francisco or someone here in Cabin John, Maryland, with a big mortgage to pay off? Janet Yellen, the Fed chair, was up on Capitol Hill this morning and was making the point that we are all set, or the Fed is all set to raise rates at some point later this year, and that'll be the first time since the crisis. But one of the big things the Fed keeps coming back to is the question of the global economy and the state of the recovery out there. How much of a threat could that be? In practical terms, the real impact that we may see here in the U.S. economy in the shorter term is that the Fed may slow down in terms of returning to normal and getting back to the kind of economic management that you would have expected pre-crisis. I mean, we are 7-8 years down the line from one of the biggest economic events in the past century, and we're still recovering from it. And that is that recovery is hit by almost anything that happens in the global economy today.
Again, Sean Donnan is with us from Maryland, from Cabin John, Maryland. He covers international economics for the Financial Times from Washington, D.C. And James Galbraith, economist and professor, University of Texas, Austin, author of The End of Normal. And let me get you on the record here on this, James Galbraith. I want to say Galbraith, excuse me. I want to say your name right. As I've told you before on the air, I was a major admirer of your father's work and also an admirer of yours. Let's get you on the record, though, about this interconnectedness.
Well, it's definitely present, no question about that. Let me say a few words to begin with about the Greek situation, because I have been spending a great deal of my time in Greece and also in other European capitals where the negotiations were going on over the past several months. I don't think there's any serious question that the Greek Parliament will approve this package that Greece has been presented basically as an ultimatum by its creditors. The reason for that is that the conservative parties have announced that they will support the package, and while the ruling party, Syriza, has split on the question, I don't think there's much doubt that the prime minister will have sufficient votes to make up a majority in the parliament.
Could I just say a word here? Because the prime minister actually said this is a one-way street for Greece. It was imposed on us. That's essentially the position he's taking now.
That is correct, and that's why I would draw, object to the use of the word deal or the word rescue, these kinds of words that have positive connotations. This is an imposed solution. It is essentially something that the Greeks were coerced into accepting under the very dire threat that if they didn't accept it, the European Central Bank would pull the plug on their banking system and the Greek depositors would lose practically the totality of what they have in the banks. And when that happened, the payment system would completely freeze up and the economy would be destroyed. So that was the nature of the threat that was made. That is why Alexis Tsipras said that this is something that's being done with a knife to his neck. I think it's fairly clear that this will destabilize Greek politics. The governing party has split over the question. Whether the prime minister will survive is an open issue at this point. If there are new elections, then I think you can be quite sure that down the road the opposition and perhaps the government will be fundamentally more anti-European than the present governing majority, which is a pro-European progressive majority. So what has happened here will have a chain of consequences that we are not even at the beginning.
Including quite possibly a turn to the right.
Including possibly a turn to the right, yes. I think that you will see very likely a revival of the neo-Nazi movement in Greece, which had been basically pushed into the shadows and the sidelines by the enormous support that the Greek public had been giving to this government by the coalition of the parties of the radical left, which, after all, won the referendum with 62% of the vote just a few days ago.
We've also got a dual currency in effect, don't we?
Excuse me?
Don't we also have a dual currency in effect, really, at this point?
Well, in a sense, in that under capital controls, the money in the Greek banks that's on deposit, it's not worth the same as a cash euro, which is why some companies are insisting on cash and why people are paying their bills so as to have as little in the bank as possible and why they're taking the 60 euro a day out of the ATMs, whether they need them or not. The paper euro worth more than the bank euro. So in that sense, but no, there is no formal parallel currency. The scrip has not been issued. IOUs have not been issued. Those measures remain available if absolutely necessary, but the government hasn't moved to them yet.
Well, your concern with Greece is certainly noted, but what about China?
Well, you know, the Chinese situation is something that we dramatize because of the importance to us of our stock market, but the stock market in China is not nearly as big a factor in the functioning of the economy there as ours is in the United States. So I think one has to be a little careful about drawing conclusions from movements in on the Shanghai Stock Exchange to the functioning of the whole Chinese economy. They were strongly affected by the crisis 7 years ago, but they were able to put policies in place that stabilized their growth rate quite quickly.
But aside from the stock market in China and aside from stocks and investments, there's a lot of concern about bad real estate loans, which could be a disaster waiting to happen. I mean, the real estate is heading south, this especially coming out of New York, of course, but there's a property bubble, and if it busts, it would be a real disaster.
I'm very well aware of that. I happen to own a small apartment in the southern city of Fuzhou, where my mother-in-law happens to live. Yes, conscious of this, but, you know, you're talking about the big movement of high-end real estate in the Shanghai and Beijing. And again, China is an enormous country, and the effect of this out on the overall economy of China has got to be a little bit like having a bust in Manhattan, and its effect on Iowa, not necessarily all that substantial.
Well, all the concern about China and Greece notwithstanding, and the interdependency of nations in this global economy, Puerto Rico also plays more of a considerable role here than certainly has been at least highlighted in the media. I mean, it could rock the municipal bond market and lead to higher borrowing. We're talking about, a real effect here at home.
That's a topic on which I have no authority to give you any opinion at all.
Could I get you to opine on that possibly, Robert Kahn?
Sure, I'll give it a shot. I do think that it's possible that the problems of Puerto Rico could have some spillover effects on the broader municipal market. But we've got to understand there's a lot of the pieces of this that are pretty idiosyncratic to Puerto Rico because of its nature of being not an independent sovereign but not having the full protections that a state would have. It has suffered, though, like places like Detroit and many other municipalities, from a declining tax base. In this case, that has to do with congressional tax policy over the last decade, but also with demographics and migration out. They've had weak fiscal policy that has been financed by markets until recently, and now they see a sudden stop in the capital flows into those countries. And so they've, as you mentioned at the start, $72 billion of debt and little prospect of financing. And at the same time, they're not able to go to a bankruptcy court and ask for some sort of stay or some sort of organized restructuring. On the other hand, unlike a country like Greece, they can't simply declare a moratorium and restructure. But so they're in this kind of netherworld where they need to be seen by Congress and by the general public as working very hard to do everything they can. But at the same time, some sort of debt restructuring, reprofiling is going to be necessary. And I think it's going to be very difficult for them to achieve it, given the complexity of the debts they have.
Let me go back, if I could, then, with you, Robert Kahn, to China. And I also want to hear you. Your thoughts on Greece, because I know you have talked and written a great deal about that and have been very close to that problem. But there is, at this point at least, a great deal of concern about what may happen in China, I suppose largely because analogies are being made to Japan. After the boom was the bust, and is the sun setting on the Chinese economy is really one of the questions that seems to loom in many economists' minds. How do you see it?
I don't think the sun is setting. I think, as was said earlier, China is going through a very difficult long-term transition from an export-driven economy to one that's more consumer-based, more service-based. That means transitioning to a lower growth rate, and that's difficult. I would be critical, though, of the way the Chinese have managed that recently. I think they have, out of concern of social stability and perhaps other considerations, fueled this bubble that James talked about in real estate, in infrastructure, and in stocks. Earlier this year, they cut interest rates a number of times, and there's been some significant stimulus programs that I think did contribute to these good numbers we got out today. But it really fueled this bubble, and I think it made the adjustment that we're now seeing all the more difficult.
Yeah, it seems now, to be stabilizing, some have called these panicky policies. Is that apt?
Well, when bubbles always burst, there's an element of panic, both in the markets and by the policymaker. We've seen this $3.5 trillion of paper losses, but as James said, it's concentrated. I do think the government's acted in a relatively panicky way. We had a lot of confidence in them, right? They have huge reserves and resources. They've had a reputation in the past of being very careful in managing disruptions to the economy. So I think we were probably overly sanguine that they could manage it. And there was this sort of panic reaction to let the burst bubble build some momentum and then step in very heavily, to the point where I think the majority of stocks aren't trading. Those that are subject to very heavy pressure from the government. So you can't really have much confidence that we've really had much of the adjustment that needs going to have to be taken. I think it has hurt the credibility of this government, which will be very important going forward as they make this broader transition.
Again, Robert Kahn is with us from Washington. He's Stephen A. Tannenbaum, Senior Fellow for International Economics with the Council on Foreign Relations. And like I said, you've written a lot about and certainly taken a great deal of interest in what's going on in Greece. How do you see this working its way out? I mean, at this point, they're talking about tax and pension reform. They're talking about spending cuts. But they're also talking about liberalizing the labor market, which may mean, I suppose, a lot of these jobs going and opening up for new possibilities of employment.
One can certainly hope that if they adopted a comprehensive set of reform policies and it returned confidence to markets and was supported by significant financing, that you could get some boost in demand from that offset the drag from these higher taxes. Things are so bad now that you could hope that it could get better. But if I could step back and maybe take a slightly different perspective than James does on the ultimatum that Greece got this past week, and I tend to look at it a little differently. I think if you go back to 2010 when this crisis hit, Greece had huge deficits and was in the midst of a financial crisis. And the central question then was, can Greece reform, become competitive, and grow within the eurozone? And a series of very generous financing programs, I would argue, have basically failed to give Greece that growth path. There have been better results in places like Ireland and Spain, but Greece it's been extraordinarily disappointing, and we can have debates over whose fault that is. But at some level, that is still the question we have and is the question that Prime Minister Tsipras faced late into the night on Sunday. He was being told that the financing needs to try and continue along this path were extraordinarily high and that the creditor governments weren't willing to do that unless they had a lot of confidence that there was at least some possibility of success where we have failed in the past. I've argued that the odds of succeeding within the eurozone are actually quite low and that there is a compelling economic case for Greece to leave the eurozone, take its own currency, depreciate, and become competitive in the longer run. But that would be extraordinarily disruptive and painful in the near term. It's scary. And I think in the middle of the night, the prime minister kind of looked over the precipice at that scenario, looked at a deal and said, I don't want exit for now. But I do think that the set of policies that are being asked of Greece are going to be very difficult for them to pass, to implement, and to sustain. And I wouldn't be surprised if Greek politics generate a different decision in the next couple of months.
Well, they had a referendum that said no to a deal that is on the table now that's really from, as we've been saying, most perspectives, a worse deal. In Greece, they're calling this a surrender. They have a hashtag, this is a coup, as far as the people's response. Hold that thought because, Robert Kahn, because I'm going to break here and I want to afford our listeners an opportunity also to join us with questions or comments. Do you... are you feeling the pain of this global economy, really, would be my first question. And are you concerned here in California or beyond, if you're listening to us on the Internet or on Sirius Satellite? And how interconnected do you feel these kind of crises are and this indebtedness is and really the stock problems and trade problems that have plagued China, which may be becoming more stabilized? But your concerns, your thoughts, your questions are welcome. Join the conversation. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us now at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're asking the question this hour, how fragile is the global economy, talking about the interdependence and instability of the world economy, but also focusing on the ongoing crisis in Greece and the concern about China's markets and certainly Puerto Rico as well as our own economy and here in California. You may have questions or comments about anything that we've touched on here with respect to specific economies and ongoing economic crises in different parts of the world, and also may have some thoughts about how they are connected or not connected. We'd like to hear from you. Again, you can join us a number of ways. You can call us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or join the conversation with your questions or comments simply by going online to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Again, Sean Donnan with us. He covers international economics from Washington for the Financial Times. And James Galbraith is an economist and professor with us this morning from Vermont, University of Texas Austin professor and author of The End of Normal. And Robert Kahn with us from Washington, D.C., who is a senior fellow for international economics with the Council on Foreign Relations. And Robert Kahn, I'm going to go to callers and emailers, but you had a thought you wanted to finish here about Greece, please.
I do too, would like to get in on that.
Well, James, why don't you jump in?
Yeah, because the story of the promise of reforms in the Greek context is an old story. Greece has been under a program for 5 years now. It experienced one of the, by a factor of three, the toughest fiscal adjustment of any European country. It has a labor market which is, I think, by substantially the most liberalized one in Europe. About 30% of wage labor in Greece is off the books entirely. The effect of this was predicted in 2010 to cost them about 5% of GDP. It has, in fact, cost them 25% of GDP. It's costing them a unemployment rate well over 25%, a youth unemployment rate well over 50%. The policies, which continually described as reforms, have been in effect for a long time. They are a complete and catastrophic failure in the Greek case, whatever they may have achieved or not achieved in Ireland. In Greece, they're total failure. And that is why it wouldn't the Syriza government was elected in January. It would have been otherwise impossible for a loose coalition of so-called of self-described radical leftists to become the government of any major country, any European country. But it happened in Greece because the previous governments had completely failed under the tutelage of the institutions to produce this promised economic reform. And the financial terms that Greece was given were not generous at all. They were not directed at Greece. They were almost entirely directed at rescuing the French and the German banks from their exposure to Greece, transferring that exposure extremely illegitimately onto the backs of the North European taxpayers, particularly the Germans. That is why this thing has become such a political impasse at the present time. So this is where we are. What we're getting imposed on Greece is a doctrinaire program which suits the politics of North Europe, but has already been tested and shown to be an utter disaster in the Greek context.
Robert Kahn, you want to come in?
Well, all the more reason to contemplate an exit. But ultimately, the choice is with the Greek government whether to try and reform within the Eurozone or leave, and at least as of now, they've done it. But I do think there's a point on the first a point on James's point about austerity. He's absolutely right that the global community badly underestimated how the recessionary forces would be associated with these reform packages. And the fall of output of 25% is equal to the Great Recession here in the United States. It's extraordinary for a non-war economy. But I would argue that in terms of a lot of the structural reforms, pension reform, tax reform and the like, vested interests in this country have prevented those measures from going ahead. And as a result, the policies that Syriza wanted to embrace, an end to austerity, an end to high debt payments and the like, even if they were feasible to achieve them, would have meant large and continuing deficits that Europe didn't want to pay for.
That's absolutely not true. The Syriza program was for small primary surpluses, which had been achieved last year, to continue. It was not to go back up to a 3.5% primary surplus, which was what was demanded, and which is unachievable and unsustainable in Greece. But, and on pensions, I'm sorry, but you're not. What you say just isn't factually accurate. Pensions have been cut on the order of 44% to 49% in Greece already. So the further cuts were going to cut people who were getting 350 euro a month down another 120 euro. It is extremely difficult. These are very fragile people. So what your elderly, low-income people on the border of destitution already, that is why the Greek government drew a red line under those pension cuts. It wasn't as though they were supporting some highly unjustifiable, lavish pensions for the elderly in Greece. Quite the contrary.
Okay. So here's the thing we disagree with, or James and I disagree with. First of all, and it comes down kind of to two things. One is, what were the policies that Syriza had embraced? Where were they going to take the country? As he said, they had committed to a 3.5% primary surplus over the longer term.
That was imposed on them in March. The Syriza program. I've been involved in it from the beginning. Mm-hmm. The program was to use a very small primary surplus that could be sustained to improve tax collections and to use the resources to support the social economy and to funnel it back into investment.
Sure, but
it was a plausible program, but it was never given a chance to be implemented because the European Central Bank basically destabilized the financial system in the interest of forcing the government back to the previous and failed memorandum of understanding. That's what's happened over the last 4 months.
Let me just intercede for a moment and go to you. I want to go to callers, but Sean Donnan, you want to weigh in here?
Yeah, look, I think what you're getting there is a flavor of just how heated a debate it is over Greece. And I think one of the big things is that you get two sides that blame each other for the problems that Greece faces now. While James is very right in saying that the ECB withdrew support from the Greek banking sector and therefore caused the banks to close and the leg down that we saw in the crisis in the last couple of weeks. Part of the reason they did that was that the government called a referendum and walked away from the negotiating table in Brussels, and then all of a sudden you had huge uncertainty over exactly where the Greek program was going to go. So I think there's a point that here at the IMF they argue that actually things were starting to work in Greece last year. We were starting to see signs of the economy returning to growth. We were starting to get under control, and then all of a sudden politics interceded and you had a change in government and what we've seen in the last 5-6 months. I think if you step way back from all of this, the issue is also that you can talk about how and the big disagreement now is about how you deal with the problem, but the big problem is debt, and that is exactly as you've been saying, Michael, the problem in the global economy that we still have today in so many different places. And you go to China. China has taken on huge debts since 2007, 2008 as a response to the crisis. The reason for the boom in the stock market over the last year has been that a lot of it has been fed by more debt, by margin lending to investors, and one of the big concerns, and one of the reasons people who watch the Chinese economy have been concerned about the links between the crash and the real economy there in China, is the question of what happens with that margin lending and those loans that have been extended to retail investors who may not be able to pay them back, and that might impact the banks, which then might feed through into the real economy and so on. Greece is right now you can disagree about how to do it, but I think everyone agrees that the situation is dire and that you need some kind of plan to get out of it. What we're seeing now is a conversation that is not going to end today and with a vote in the Greek parliament, but it's going to continue for months to come.
Well, let me say that I'm looking at listener response here, and many people do want to focus on Greece. So let me bring some of our callers in. And Steve, let me begin with you. You're on the air. Good morning.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for taking the call. I'm a Greek American, and for years we tried to do business in Greece to no avail. I don't disagree with anything either one of the gentlemen are talking about, but they're talking about numbers and the people on the fringe and whatever else. But what about the responsibility for the last 40 years of the governments that have been running Greece? You know, one minute they're talking about, I don't want to be treated like children, but, you know, there's 200 billion euros in debt with a population of under 12 million people. And just think about that. And I'll give you an example. I could tell you about my last catastrophe over there 20 years ago, but I have a cousin who's an ambassador for Canada for Dubai, and she's very Greek. And we were having dinner last week, and she was telling me that when the Chinese took over half of the port of Piraeus, as an example, the Chinese this year wanted to take over the other half. The Greek government, of course, said no, because, you know, they can run it much better. The half that the Chinese took over, they took one division. It had 250 workers. They modernized it, and they're down to 10 people, which tells you that 240 people were doing nothing there all these years. So when you start to see about you got to pay off doctors. They have the best medicine because they don't use generic medicine. To me, the biggest problem there is the institutions have to be cleaned out. Forget about who owes who what at this point. Nothing is going to work until you realize that there's a few oligarchs in this country. You can't even import fish, frozen fish, into Greece. At least you couldn't do it up 5 years ago because they would have blocked you. Until you close out these corrupt government officials, especially in the tax department there, that have the 40-40-20 policy. I don't know if your gentlemen know that. But if you owe 1,000 euros in your store, tax man comes over and says, look, if you give me 400, you keep 400, and we'll say you only owe 200. There's one story after another.
Steve, let me take the gist of your comments here and go to Professor Galbraith on this.
Everything that he said, we've heard many, many times, and there's an enormous amount of truth to it. And that is why the previous two parties, the New Democracy Party and PESOK, were swept away in the previous elections. That is why the Greek people put in a group of people who'd never been in power before and who, in fact, did have and do have an agenda of going after and taking on the oligarchs. That is part of what Syriza is all about. How much progress have they made? Well, they haven't been able to make very much because in the 5 months of their existence, they've been entirely preoccupied with trying to save the country from the diktat of the memorandum.
I want to bring more of our...
Hold on, just a couple of other things. If one believes that the IMF was right about the recovery last year, if that were even remotely true, there's no chance that Syriza would have won the election. It won the election precisely because it wasn't true. And on a final point, the ECB did get into the closing the banks on the eve of the referendum. It was clearly putting its thumb on the scale as part of a campaign to intimidate the Greek public into accepting the terms that had been dictated on the 25th of June to the government. It was very much to the credit of the Greek public that they stood up and said no to that, that they stood up in great numbers and without a lot of encouragement to resist that. But then, of course, the pressure escalated, and now they've been really put under the knife, and they've buckled.
Well, let me thank Steve for his call. And this has been pretty much a lot of how the debate has been framed all along about Greece. I mean, about what Steve brought up in the way of corruption, and we frequently hear about the indolence and the dependency of many of the pensioners and the people who are not working and so forth, and Germany talking about the need for tightening belts and austerity. And I'm just looking at a listener email here. It says, Greece is not a victim. It joined the euro under false pretenses, hiring Goldman Sachs to cook the books. Then for a decade, it lied to creditors, EU authorities, and the Greek people themselves, borrowing more money to prop up a corrupt patronage state. With a population less than a third of California, Greece has already received two bailouts equal to 1 year's GDP and is now in line for a third rescue. Beggars can't be choosers, and the notion that the EU is holding a knife to Cyprus's neck is just knee-jerk lefty hyperbole. Let me bring another caller on, and that's you. John, you're on.
Yes, good morning, Michael, and thanks for taking my call. My question is this. Would countries like Greece, the Southern European group, would they be better off not joining the euro to begin with? In other words, they do not have the fiscal management controls, fiscal sophistication of a Netherlands or a Germany or whatever. They don't know anything about budgetary controls, apparently. They just don't fit in. The political, social, cultural ethos of those Southern European countries, Greece especially, just doesn't match with the Northern Europeans. And it's absurd to think that countries in Denmark and Netherlands and Germany are going to pay taxes in perpetuity to prop up Southern European countries. All the Northern Europeans dutifully pay their taxes because they want their elaborate welfare states, but they pay the bill.
Robert Kahn, let me hear from you.
Yeah, Europe is an imperfect economic and financial union. And that means that if you desire to run policies that are very different from the largest countries in that region, it is a huge risk to come into a currency union because you're giving up your autonomy over monetary and fiscal policy. And that's why, even though in principle all members of the European Union ultimately are supposed to come into the Eurozone. What you see is countries like Poland, for example, that have made it very clear that they have no interest in doing so and that they believe they will grow and do better outside the zone. I think that's probably the right judgment. And I do think that for countries that are at a very different stage of development or have very different politics, they need to be very wary about giving up the financial independence that comes with joining a monetary union.
Let me go to a question.
Can I just come in on that?
James Galbraith, go ahead.
This is not a cultural question. The Greeks, in fact, work longer hours than the Germans do. They take fewer vacations. This is a question of the fact that the industrial power is concentrated in the north of Europe. And once the Eurozone was formed, Germany started running an enormous trade surplus, which had to be financed, meaning that the rest of the southern countries all went into deficits of one form or another, and that made them vulnerable to the financial collapse in 2009. Mm-hmm. So it's an organic problem of the imbalance of the Eurozone. And yes, of course, Greece would have been much better off if it had never joined in the first place.
Can I just add one thing? It's Sean here. There's a point that we always need to remember when we're thinking about Europe and we're thinking about the European Union or the Euro, is that this is a political project. The economics are secondary. This has been, from the very beginning, a political project that is about building greater unity and greater links within Europe, and the euro is part of that, and that's why it wasn't so well thought out and why it has so many weaknesses economically.
Sean, we had a caller who did not join us, and I'm wondering what you say to this caller who actually hung up. It raised a question that's sort of hovering around in my consciousness. Is there any link from the 2008 U.S. meltdown and the bank bailouts for euro instability?
Of course there is. What happened was that after 2008, the whole world investment community fled to the safe assets, which are U.S. treasuries and German bonds and British gilts, and they fled out of the real estate market in Spain and the commercial real estate market in Ireland and government bonds in Greece, and that is what crashed the south of Europe. That's absolutely part of a global financial adjustment that occurred in 2009-2010.
Here we have another listener who writes the following, reminding of historical memory, saying, I seem to recall the last two times Germany insisted it was a victim of its European neighbors. The first was after the Treaty of Versailles, when it defaulted on its debt, and the second was in 1953, when more than in the post-war debt had to be forgiven in Germany. Chancellor Merkel, have you no economic memory? How did Germany pay for its massive war machine post-Treaty of Versailles? It sure wasn't because they were making debt payments demanded by Europe. And another listener says, why doesn't the European Union create a fiscal union that can be in charge of cutting spending in these countries to make sure this doesn't happen again? It just feels like this will continue to happen if there are no major changes. Sean Donnan?
Well, I think that last question gets into the limits of politics. I mean, the Greeks want to maintain sovereignty over their budget, just as the British do. And one of the questions we're going to be pondering in over the next couple of years is Britain's relationship with the European Union as they gear up for a referendum there on whether to stay in the European Union. So, I mean, there is this tension between sovereignty and politics and what needs to happen economically for the euro and Europe to work.
And here's a caller. Frank, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Professor Galbraith, I would suggest that I mentioned your knife comment that the Greeks forged it and sharpened it. However, I do agree with your comment about the transfer of the bank debt to the government. Does that mean that if you were the diktat issuer, that you would propose a haircut? And if so, would it accompany any domestic political changes in Greece?
Well, the Greek proposal was for the Europeans stability mechanism, the ESM, to take over the debts of the IMF, owed to the IMF and the ECB, and extend them out to very long maturities. That could be done with or without a haircut. If you do it without a haircut, you have to, as the IMF was saying a day or two ago, you have to give them a 30-year grace period and very low interest rates afterwards. So it's just an unprecedented, let's say, extension of the maturities, and it comes out to roughly the same thing. Much better, in my view, to clear the books and take a large share of that debt off the books and just admit that it's not going to be paid, but that is something that the Germans find utterly unpalatable for their own political reasons.
Let me thank Frank for the call. And Robert Kahn, how much do you see, let's just talk about for a moment the role of the IMF in all this. We've been talking a great deal about Germany, but it's central, too.
IMF is in a really tough spot here. They do have the concerns that James expressed, that the debt is far too high, and they would like to see the kind of policies creditors want, but coupled with the kind of debt relief James has called for. But they also recognize the Germans, for precedential reasons, are very resistant to it. That has become an ongoing battle. And I think their broad concern is that we have this large financing need. The Europeans will kind of move ahead of the fund and put some money on the table, but not in sufficient amount. And that will leave a large part of the financing to the IMF at a time when they are already being criticized for lending into these situations. And so they're really in a very tough spot. They would like to set up very tough rules for this program to go ahead. But frankly, it is a political decision. At the end, if major countries decide Greece should get a program, the IMF cannot walk away from that, and they will be forced to lend on creditors' terms. And that will be difficult for their reputation in the longer term. It really is part, if I can just say, on a broader issue, that really over the last 20 years or so, capital markets have grown very large, faster than the fund's resources. And so the requirements of the fund to lend to countries that are having financial crises, and that's true whether it was Korea in 1997, Mexico in 1994, or Greece and Spain today, in many ways are outstripping what their rules say they should be doing. And that tension is going to continue.
And we'll bring another caller on. Wanda, thank you for waiting. Join us. You're on Forum.
Thank you. Worldwide, countries have incurred and are continuing to incur these debts from the World Bank, the IMF, other institutions, mega institutions. It usually goes to infrastructure and building ports. It has little to do with small individuals, small businesses. I would like to ask everyone who's listening, follow the money. First of all, how much of it is interest? What was the money spent on in different countries? Who benefited? And if it's always spent on infrastructure, ports, other things to do with world trade, often the little guy not only doesn't benefit, but he gets moved off his land. And what individuals and companies benefit worldwide? And shouldn't they be responsible when a debt comes in? Shouldn't the companies and the individuals, the oligarchs of the world, be responsible for the debt, not the small guy, not the pensioner, the farmer in Zimbabwe, the pensioner in Greece, whatever? They're the people who suffer.
All right, Wanda, I thank you for raising those salient questions, and I'm also looking at an email here from a listener that I want to bring into the mix, because Rick writes, since Wanda was talking about indebtedness, he says, I wonder how your experts feel about the extraordinary run-up of U.S. debt in the last 8 years. I'm saddened by this excess and feel that it's unfair to all the children whom will be forced to, by necessity, to pay for this grand waste. We're back to the United States here, Professor Galbraith.
Well, the U.S. is in an entirely different position. In fact, the debt burden of the U.S., such as if you want to call it a burden, is entirely a sustainable proposition. The U.S. did really quite well, quite effectively, recovered from the Great Crisis of 2008 using the institutions that already existed in the country, by and large, which included the social insurance programs, but also included the willingness of the Congress to finance some investment programs. So this was money, I think, well spent, and the fact is that the financial position of the United States remains extremely strong, and that's evidenced by the fact that anytime there's a crisis, everybody goes to buy U.S. Treasury bonds and bills. It's a very different situation from the Greeks, who have no access to the private markets and who are subject to the terms of dictation of their creditors. There is no creditors' cabal that could bring that kind of leverage to bear on the United States. So I think really the comparison is quite misplaced.
What about the point, though, Sean Donnan, if I could get back to Wanda's call, that a lot of this indebtedness has been incurred by call it politics or the infrastructures, and she kept talking about ports and trade and all that, and the reality is, from her perspective and probably from many other people's, those who ought to be culpable and ought to be held responsible are those who are making these great profits, be they oligarchs or multinationals.
Look, I mean, I think what Wanda's getting at is one of the great issues of our time, which is globalization has has created all sorts of change, and we're trying to figure it all out, and gets back to that interconnected world that you were talking about. I'm not sure that investment in ports or things that make trade easier are things that hurt the little guy. That's a debate on the impact of trade and globalization. There's a lot of people nowadays who, whether it's via eBay or other online channels, are actually turning themselves into sort of mini multinationals, as some people talk about. They're exporting to the world. They're becoming much more engaged in the global economy. Any kind of infrastructure that helps them do that is actually something that helps the little guy. But I think that what Juan is getting at is suspicion and pain, really. And I think throughout all of this, whether it's here in the U.S. or in Greece, what we're seeing around us is the shadow of this great economic event that happened in 2008. And I think that's and that has hurt us, it hurt people, or been reflected in different ways. The U.S. economy is in a much better place than most other economies in the world right now.
Well, that may be so, although I'm looking at an email here from a listener who says Illinois doesn't look all that different from Greece to me in terms of total debt and population. Maybe Illinois will suffer dearly for it, but it's hard to imagine anything similar to what Greece is enduring. Let me thank all of our guests for this enlightening hour. I want to express my appreciation to James Galbraith, to Robert Kahn, and to Sean Donnan, and to you, our listeners. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Vinnie Tong. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. Engagement producer Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.